This is the Morrow Midday Show.
But wait, there's more.
On ESPN Radio.
Gensler's back again. Shady's back. Tell a friend. Guess who's back.
Final hour of the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. Coming up, some thoughts on Major League Baseball. The Braves with a nice win yesterday. And which college football teams will be the best over the next 3 years? We'll get into that coming up. If you ever miss anything from the show, catch it on demand. Just search ESPN Radio Charleston. However you listen to your podcast, and the podcasts are also available online, charlestonsportsradio.com. Just click on our show page and find the show podcasted there. While you're there, don't forget about our golf tour. Every Monday, 8 a.m., a new foursome goes on sale. Head over to charlestonsportsradio.com and set your alarms to get your foursome for just $98.9. Next Monday, starting at 8 a.m. when the new week goes on sale, because those foursomes go quick. charlestonsportsradio.com to take advantage of our 2022 summer golf tour with the latest round of foursomes becoming available next Monday, 8 a.m. Hey, North Greenville won the national championship this year in baseball. We were talking about it at the time, about 10 days ago, as they were pulling it off. And joining us now is the head coach of the North Greenville baseball program, former big leaguer, former Gamecock as well, Landon Powell's with us. Landon, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm doing great, Luke. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, appreciate the time. I know it's been about a week and a half. How does it feel to be a national championship head coach now?
Yeah, it feels good. The congratulatory messages and those kind of things are not getting old. I love them to keep coming, although I know that, you know, time's going to wear off here and it's going to get back to normality. But, no, it's been fun. We've been on cloud nine, just proud of these players and what we've accomplished. And, it's been a really fun several years turning this program around. And to have the opportunity to go out this year and win it all was it was a dream come true for a lot of these players and coaches, and just really blessed to have that opportunity.
Yeah, now you won a lot as a player. I know you won medals. I think you won some state titles in high school, the SEC championship. Obviously, in the big leagues, you caught a perfect game. How did this compare as the coach, not playing in these games, but instead coaching a team? How did this win, this championship, compare to some of the others in your career?
Coaching is totally different because you don't really – get to have a huge or as big an impact on the game. I mean, you do. I call some steal signs and some bunt signs, and I make some pitching decisions here and there. And you know, I called a lot of our pitches in the World Series. So I have some small impact on the game, but I don't get to swing the bat or throw the ball or, you know, whatever. And so it's nerve-wracking. You know, you feel kind of helpless sometimes as a coach. Like, man, I hope he gets this hit. I hope he makes this play. And honestly, there's a fan part of you that comes out as a coach because you're rooting for your players and you're cheering them on in big moments. And then when they make that play, it's kind of like watching your favorite sports team, you know, your favorite player get a big hit in that situation. Like you're so proud of them, and you feel like you know, you have their back and you're right there in it with them, even though you're not actually on the field. And so that's transitioning from a player to a coach has been interesting. As a player, I never thought about things as much because I was in the game, I was in the moment, and I could make the impact. And as a coach, you think about it way more because you're trying to analyze every little thing and get whatever edge you can. It's been equally as fulfilling. I love coaching. I've really enjoyed teaching these guys the way to play the game, you know, showing them a lot of little nuances that maybe they didn't understand or know about, and how those things have helped them mature as players and have success on the field. It's fulfilling being a coach. And this year was the ultimate. You know, not only these guys figured out how to play the game the right way, but they figured out how to kind of love the game and really love the process and enjoy the play. You know, I told some folks after the national championship, these guys, you know, they'd go play on a cow pasture with nobody watching and play just as hard as they did for that national championship. I had a group of guys this year that just loved to play baseball, And it doesn't matter the situation or the scenario. They just want to be on the field playing. And as a coach, that's all you can ask for.
You mentioned how it was an interesting transition. You made it seem like a natural transition. You came right off the field as a player. Your first job as a coach professionally here is with North Greenville. And in your first year, you guys won only 8 games. Now you're national champions. I mean, what was the most important part? What was the key to turning around this program? Because you've done such a great job in a short amount of time building up the North Greenville baseball program.
Yeah, the first year was a really impactful season. So the 8-win team was actually the year before I got here. So okay. I inherited an 8-win program. Our first year, we were picked to finish dead last in the conference, understandably. They had only won 2 conference games the year before. In our first year, we actually went out and won the conference championship, 2015. So we won 29 games that first year. So that was a 21-game improvement from the previous year before I got here. That year gave us a ton of momentum. It kind of opened some eyes in the area of like, hey, they're playing some real baseball now at North Greenville, and you know we have 3 guys get drafted off of that team, so that helped in recruiting. Some other guys wanting to come here and see if they could get their foot in the door professionally. And the next year, I think we won 38 games, so it was from 8 wins to 38 wins in 2 years. That turnaround really just kind of pumped a lot of it just gave some lifeblood to the program and. A lot of momentum. So that helped us in recruiting to get the next best caliber player. And we just continued to, raise the bar here. And, we had some teams in 2018 and 2019 that were national championship caliber teams. I mean, they were every bit as good as the team I coached this year. And they're teams that could have won the championship. But, for whatever reason, the ball didn't bounce our way or we didn't get the big hit in the big situation. And that's how baseball works. But the last 3 or 4 years here, we've started practice in the fall. Knowing that we had a good enough roster to win a national championship, and then it was all going to be about, how healthy they stayed and how well they gelled and came together, and then how they performed. So this year, the team was able to get it done, it's been fun. It's been 7 years. If you would have told me 7 years ago that we'd be winning a national championship, I just don't know if I'd have believed that. But we've worked hard every day, and we've had a plan. We've not settled or been complacent. We consistently push for more and to get better. And it's worked out for us.
Talking with Landon Powell, who is the head coach of North Greenville. They just won the national championship 11 days ago. What I like about your team, just from looking at the stats, trying to learn about your program, I'm an old-school baseball guy. I love how much you guys run. You had 145 stolen bases this year, which nowadays in baseball seems almost unbelievable. I mean, how important is it to, when other teams may not be doing it, to keep that speed and the stolen bases as such a big part of what you guys seem to do?
That was something I learned as a player. I was a catcher in my career, and when we would go play teams that ran a lot, it just constantly put pressure on you. And I used to hate competing against those teams, like the Anaheim Angels. Their entire minor league system, when I was coming up against those guys, like Eric Ibar and Howie Kendrick and Sean Siggins and all these guys, they just ran every time they got on. And so you're constantly having to slide step as a pitcher. You're having to throw a lot more fastballs to have a chance to shut down the running game. You're picking over, and so pitchers don't get in a rhythm. They can lay down a bunt. They can go first and third on a single. They turn singles into doubles by stealing bags. So I always kind of like that brand of baseball, and so I've tried to bring it here to North Greenville. I think we have a unique combination of power and speed here. We had 6 guys in our starting lineup that hit 10-plus home runs, and then we also had 5 guys that stole 20-plus bases. So, right at – I think one guy might have had 18 or 19. But, regardless – we could run and we could hit the ball over the fence. And so I think we had a pretty dynamic offense, and that just creates a lot of pressure and it doesn't let up on the other team. And you draw a walk, steal a bag, that's just as good as a double. And you're getting guys in scoring position. Also, we could lay down a bunt because we had speed, so that third baseman had to play in on us a little bit, and that helped a lot of ground balls scoot right past them at third that were extra base hits. We could lay down a bunt to put pressure on you to move runners over, but you have to hurry because our guy can run at the plate, and now you're throwing the ball away, and that's a couple runs. It's just pressure is a great thing in baseball, and that's what we want our offense to always create.
Yeah, that's interesting because you, as a player, were a bit of a home run hitter yourself, but as you said, as a catcher, it was so frustrating to have to deal with that speed. So when you look at baseball and the direction it's moving, I'm making an assumption here, but it seems like you like some of those old school factors that have been leaving the game for now, the home runs, where baseball, right, is becoming all home run, strikeout, or walk. What do you think of the modern baseball nowadays and how it's being played by a lot of people or teams or organizations?
So I think the game is a pendulum, and I think it's swung in the wrong direction for now. That's my personal opinion. I was a power guy. I didn't steal many bases. I mean, I stole one base in my major league career, you know, so I was not a base stealer, you know, but I was a home run guy. The game now, like you said, is home runs and strikeouts, and that's because of the analytics that a lot of these MIT and Harvard guys have done. They've looked at, you know, what produces the most runs and what teams have the best chance of winning per at bat. You know, it's the home run. I mean, that, it's not hard to figure that out, that you get a point every time you hit one over the fence. But, you know, it's hard to hit the ball over the fence consistently, especially with the pitching nowadays and how good those pitchers have become. And so, you know, you've been paying attention to the teams that are getting all the home run guys, like the Yankees, for example. They have a lineup full of guys that are going to hit 25, 30 home runs. Well, they're not winning any championships right now. Now, this year, they look pretty good, so we'll see what happens. But, you know, they've been trying to win via home run the last 10 years or so, and it hasn't been working. I'm watching baseball thinking, man, the teams that are winning, like the Braves last year or the Astros or the Dodgers, these teams actually, they do run the bases well. They have higher on-base percentages. They play great outfield defense. They're doing some things differently. It's not just gorilla ball that's winning championships. And I've always been a big believer that the game will swing back. That pendulum will swing. Some front offices and GMs will realize, man, we can win without the homer. We can steal some bases. We can try the hit and run. We can lay down some bunts and break the shift. We can go first to third on singles and be more aggressive on the base paths. And I think that that brand will always work in baseball. It will always work. And I hope they go back to it mainly, Luke, because I think it's more fun to watch. I think baseball with the strikeout and the home run can get boring. And I want kids, and I want kids to love to watch it. We need more action. We need the game to move quicker. We need this next generation to love watching baseball as much as they love watching football or basketball, so that our game continues to grow. And I'm afraid that the strikeout and the home run might be losing some people. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I'm with you 100%. I've said a lot of the same things over the months and years when it comes to baseball. You mentioned analytics. You were obviously a catcher. So in your playing days, when you met with the starting pitcher before the game to go over the plan, were the analytics involved at all in your playing days, or has that just ramped up, you know, since you've left professional baseball?
No, it is definitely involved in our days. I mean, they have Major League Baseball, when I was playing, had a system called BAT, a computerized system. You go in, I mean, I could go grab Derek Jeter and I could say, show me every 0-2 slider that he's ever put in play. And it'll bring up all of them. And then I can go and click on the actual pitch, and it will show me video of that swing. I mean, it's crazy the amount of data that you have at your fingertips at the major league level. So, I mean, I would go and do hours of research almost every start, you know, on the opposing team, on pitch counts, on, you know, if I had a sinker guy that I was going to catch that day, I'd go find other sinker pitchers that had pitched against this team and, you know, break down video of what success they had or what things they struggled with. And then you go meet with the pitcher and the pitching coach, and they've also done their own video, and you guys are all bouncing ideas off each other, and you formulate a good game plan. So there's a lot more goes into being a major league player, especially as a catcher, than just, you know, hitting some balls in the cage and, you know, warming up before the game. I mean, there's just so much that goes into it, and I love that part of it. It was every day. It was like going to school. You're learning new things. You're figuring more things out that can help you, and that was a fun part of it for me.
Couple of last moments with Landon Powell, who played in the big leagues, played for the Gamecocks, now a national champion head coach for North Greenville. Of course, maybe most notably when it came to your catching career was when you caught the perfect game with Dallas Braden. I remember it on Mother's Day, you know, over a decade ago now. What's that like when you're a catcher? You know, I've broadcasted no-hitters and never a perfect game. I've talked to the catcher, but never at the professional level. What's it like when you're locked in with your starting pitcher, and in this case, you guys were perfect that day against Tampa?
You know, Dallas and I got drafted the same year, same draft. So we came up in the minor leagues all the way together. That day probably was, who knows, the 70th time I had caught him in our careers. So I was very familiar with him, comfortable with him. Same with him, and I, you know, he was comfortable with me. Dallas was a average to below average major league pitcher at that point in his career, you know, didn't have great numbers. I was a backup catcher in my second year in the big leagues. I mean, I would play once, maybe twice a week. So the statistical probability of us being in the lineup that day, the two, and that happening is just so small. And, you know, it was the 19th perfect game in history over a 140 year period. And, it was just a magical day. I don't know how else to explain it, man. I just felt like it was just the stars aligned, and you know, God showed us favor, and it worked out. As a catcher during the game, I didn't even really think about it until maybe the fifth inning or so, and I realized, and I don't think there's no hits. Like, he's got a freaking no-hitter going in the fifth. But as a catcher, that's happened so many times where you had a no-hitter going in the fifth or sixth, and you're just like, something will happen. But that day it didn't, and then all of a sudden it was like the sixth or seventh, and I'm sitting there thinking, man, still no hits. I'm not sure anybody's even been on base. And I started, like, racking my brain. I was like, there hasn't been a walk or anything. I was like, my gosh, he's got a perfect game. Then you get nervous. You're like, oh, crap. Like, I hope I don't call the wrong pitch. And I hope I don't, you know. There's not much as a catcher you can really screw up in a perfect game. You know, I'm not going to have a pass ball. I guess the strike three could get by me. But I wasn't worried about that. Or I guess I couldn't feel the bunt, maybe. But other than that, there's not a whole lot that I can screw up. So just making sure I was calling the right pitches and just praying that they hit it right at people. And that's how it worked out. It was a magical day. It's something I'll never forget. Definitely one of my top favorite days on the baseball field.
Yeah, I can imagine so. Whenever we have no hitters or perfect games, we always talk about the pitcher. We should include the catchers in these as well. You're the one calling the game, and you and Braden worked so well on that day about 12 years ago. I'm sure it's like picking your favorite child, but if I were to ask you, who is the most impressive pitcher you ever caught during your lengthy career?
That I caught?
Yeah.
That's a tough question. Big league level, the A's, we never had any, like, superstars. We had some guys that made all-star games. I mean, Gio Gonzalez and Trevor Cahill and Andrew Bailey. Andrew Bailey was rookie of the year. Those guys all were pretty special. Just had some really lively stuff early in their careers. None of them ended up being, now, they've all had 10-year major league careers and have been very successful, but maybe not household names. I caught some guys. Josh Hamilton's a guy I grew up playing with. And, when we were in Little League, he threw four no-hitters in a row to win a state championship.
Wow.
That was when we were 12. But, I played with him all the way through high school and everything, and he was a 97-mile-per-hour left-handed pitcher, and nothing was straight. I've been fortunate to catch a lot of guys, Houston Street and a guy named Kyle Sleeth that went to Wake Forest in high school, was the number 4 overall pick in the draft. He was a 96-97 righty in college. There's been some really good ones over the years. Unfortunately, I think the best pitchers I've ever been, were guys that I faced. I wish I would have caught guys like Tim Lincecum and Roy Halladay and, those kind of pitchers. But I usually was always hitting off of them, and it's way less fun to hit off of them than it is to catch them, I can promise you.
Yeah, I'm sure. Two last things for you. As we talk with Landon Powell, just won a national championship with North Greenville about 10 days ago. We have, I guess you could say, some sort of connection. I was at a game at Fenway Park 11 years ago, went 14 innings. You caught that game for Oakland. I don't know if you have any recollection of this game in Boston, but what's it like as a catcher to have to catch 14 innings in the big leagues?
All right, so I'll give you recollection of that game. So I'm a backup catcher. So it's my rookie year in the big leagues. I'm hitting in the 8-hole, so I pretty much know going into every game, if I just get a hit, like, I'm probably going to get 3, maybe 4 at-bats. So if I get a hit, I'm going to be a 250 hitter, and I'm going to stay in the big leagues for 10 years. As a backup catcher, hitting 250, catching, calling a good game, throwing guys out stealing, you can play forever in the big leagues. So we're playing that day. It's hot, day game. Josh Beckett is pitching, and he's one of the best pitchers in the league. And my first at-bat, I hit a ground ball to the right side through the infield for a base hit. And I think it might have been RBI, but I'm on first base, and I'm thinking, I'll tell you in that moment, all right, cool. I got my one hit. Now cruise control the rest of the day. Like, I'm good. I can go 1-for-3 or 1-for-4, and, like, I'm living up to my numbers as a backup catcher, and I can stay in this game forever. That's just kind of a simple mindset. I'm, kind of half-joking, but that's true. Well, I, get up the next at bat. I hit a ball in the gap. Jacoby Ellsbury goes over and makes a diving catch. It was, like, the number 2 play on SportsCenter that night. All right, so he robbed me of a double. I get up my third at-bat, I think Bobby Jinks was pitching, he strikes me out. I get up my fourth at-bat, I think they bring in Papelbon, he strikes me out. I get up my fifth at-bat, which is an extra inning now, it's like the 12th inning, and Alcides Esteves, I think is his name, the Mexican pitcher, he strikes me out. So now I get my first hat trick of my major league career. And then I come up in the 14th inning, game on the line, and I strike out for the 4th time. So I started 1-for-1 that day thinking cruise control, this is going to be an easy day. And I ended 1-for-6 with 4 strikeouts. And all I did is I went back to my hotel and buried myself in my sheets and just, sulked the rest of the day because I was now an embarrassment rather than thinking, I was going to be 1-for-4 and be in cruise control. So that's how a backup catcher can think sometimes in the big leagues. And, you know, it did not end the way I wanted it to. But I do remember that day like it was yesterday, I promise you.
That's a great story. I'm sorry to bring up a bad memory. It was a lot more fun for me in the stands than dealing with that. Before we let you go, Landon, I know you've been asked before about, you know, returning to your alma mater as the coach one day of the Gamecocks. I won't ask you specifically about that, but I am curious about aspirations. You know, if you stayed with North Greenville for 20 years, would you be content with that? Are you looking to maybe one day get to the big leagues? What are your goals as a coach now that you know, you're a national championship head coach? What are your aspirations as a coach?
You know, things have changed a little bit after I got into coaching. When I first got into coaching right from retiring from the big leagues, I wanted to climb the ladder fast, and I wanted to get to the highest level and show what I could do, and that was kind of my player's brain still affecting me as a coach. Now that I've gotten into coaching, I really value the relationships. I enjoy the niche that I'm in. I feel like I'm making an impact on the game. I'm making an impact on the players that I deal with every day. And sometimes I think if I wasn't here, would this same impact being made on these guys? And that makes me value where my feet are. My wife and I have young kids. We love Greenville. My son's just turned 13. My daughter's 9. So we're not, like, itching to go anywhere. We're not itching to move. We're very happy where we are. This is a good season of life for us. I've made it very clear that, you know, my alma mater is a place that I just love dearly, and they were great with me in my career. It helped shape me as a man. So any opportunity I would have to go back there, I would have to consider. You know, I feel like I owe that school. And so if they ever wanted me back, I would definitely have to consider that. You know, other than that, I'm not, like, looking for opportunities. I'm not itching to go places. I'm very happy where my feet are. And if I stayed at North Greenville the next 20 years and coach, I think I could definitely be happy with that. I've accomplished a lot in my career as a player, and so that helped me check some boxes off of my list that I don't feel like I'm chasing as much as a coach. And I feel like I can kind of, you know, pour into these players and these athletes I'm coaching now and try to pay it forward to their generation. So I can do that here at North Greenville just as good as I can anywhere else. So if that's my number one motivation, then what am I looking for? So that's kind of an answer to that question. You know, I'm also a very open-minded person, and anybody that wants to talk to me about something, I'm always, you know, willing to listen. But I could see myself here at North Greenville for a long time and enjoying doing what I'm doing.
He's Landon Powell. He's the head coach at North Greenville. He just won a national championship, played in the big leagues, played for the Gamecocks as well. Landon, I know we kept you long, so appreciate all the time and the insight and the stories as well. Congratulations on that national championship, and we'd love to catch up with you at some point down the road as well.
Thank you, Luke. Appreciate you having me on, man.
Hey, pleasure's all ours. Appreciate it. Landon Powell, the head coach at North Greenville. A pretty good recall. I always say this about athletes. It's amazing how they can remember things so well from their career. My father will tell me stories from his playing days, and I don't want to date him too much, but it was quite a while ago, and he remembers, you know, the play-by-play from games all these years ago. It's remarkable. Appreciate the time from Landon, and congratulations to North Greenville winning the national championship about less than 2 weeks ago. Big-time win for them, and a great job done by Landon turning that program around in a short amount of time. When we come back, some thoughts on baseball. Big win for the Braves last night as well. We'll get to that coming up. It's the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Now back to the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
It's the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. Appreciate the time. Last segment from Landon Powell. Played in the big leagues, played with the Gamecocks. Now the head coach at North Greenville. They just won a national championship. He's probably doing more press now than in his actual playing days. He's all over the place doing all sorts of interviews. And, you know, he's an interesting guy to talk to. He's a good interview. Appreciate the time from him. And, of course, now a national champion as well. That doesn't hurt. If you ever miss anything from the show, such as that conversation, you can find it on demand. Search ESPN Radio Charleston. However, you listen to your podcast. Two things to follow up. Number one, again, I'm always impressed with how good the memory is of these athletes. He nailed just about every pitcher in that scenario of his game at Fenway all those years ago that went 14 innings. And I remember that game as well. Now, I had to jog my memory, right? They call me Rain Man around here. But this one I didn't actually remember for sure. I always look at my Facebook memories. It's the only reason why I use Facebook. And I see what I was posting about 10 years ago. And usually it has to do with sports. The more things change, the more they stay the same. Usually only talking about sports. And so I saw It was we just passed the anniversary. It was like June 4th, 2011, I think it was. I had posted about going to the Red Sox game. And so I said, oh, what game was that? Then I looked up the game. And once I looked it up, I remembered being at that game. I went with my father. He made me drive. And because I got to drive, I also got to choose the music. And we listened to, I used to love this band. I don't think they're together anymore. Good Old War, great band out of Philadelphia. And we listened to their album on the way home after a 14-inning game. It was like a six-hour game. Fortunately, it was a day game. And then the Red Sox won. And then you hop in the car. I had to drive back from Boston. Good time. And he was Landon Powell's the catcher for all 14 innings there for the A's against the Red Sox. Appreciate the time. The other thing, too, is, you know, he caught that perfect game with Dallas Braden, who I think Braden's the youngest pitcher to throw a perfect game. He was like 26 at the time. He did it on Mother's Day. I was just talking about this yesterday on the show about how these things always seem to happen with these emotional connections. He did it with his grandmother in attendance who raised him, Dallas Braden, that is, the pitcher. His grandmother was in attendance. His mother had passed away from cancer when he was young, so his grandmother raised him. Grandmother comes to the game on Mother's Day. He throws a perfect game. It's perfect. He went over, hugged his grandmother afterwards. It was it was a really cool moment back in 2010 for Dallas Braden and the A's. But a lot has been made about Gerrit Cole had a no-hitter for the Yankees last night that he took to the eighth inning. Michael Kay is the TV broadcaster for the Yankees, and everybody was giving him a hard time because he kept mentioning the fact that there was a no-hitter. This is something that I have always been, people are very strongly opinionated about this as a broadcaster, and I've told other young broadcasters who weren't following through, but I can't stand when people complain about the broadcaster jinx for a no-hitter, how you're not supposed to say anything. It's your job to inform the audience. People may be tuning in for the first time. You have to say it. And if you think that the broadcaster has any control over what happens on the field based off of the words they choose, right, that's nonsense. But the story I remember was when I was in minor league baseball, we had a no-hitter. I was saying it throughout the broadcast, and multiple people called the radio station to complain that I was saying that there was a no-hitter, which is so absurd to me, especially on radio, where you could tune in and have no idea. At least on TV, they could put a graphic up, and the broadcaster wouldn't have to say it. On radio, you're tuning in, you have no idea. I got to tell the story. A no-hitter going on. So it's been a big argument here the last about 16 hours from last night. Michael Kay's taken a lot of heat online from ridiculous baseball fans. But everybody's saying, right, the broadcaster can't mention a no-hitter when it's going on. Now, that's garbage. It's your job to tell the story, and they have no impact on the game. And I kept Landon Powell long enough, but if we had even more time, I would have asked him about superstitions. Because I get it from a player perspective, right? You're not supposed to talk to the guy in the dugout. I get that. Let him be, do his own thing. But that's actually involving the pitcher. For the broadcaster, they can't hear what you're saying. It doesn't make a difference what you say. By the way, if I had a no-hitter going or a perfect game, I think I'd want people to be talking. I want to be distracted. I know I'm locked into the game, but like I wouldn't want to be. They always let you sit by yourself in the corner, and everybody ignores you. And they don't talk to him. He's got a no-hitter going. Like that almost adds more pressure to me. I'm looking around like, hey, how come no one's coming near me? I feel weird. It'd throw me off. No one can talk to you. You try to go talk to somebody, they don't want to like talk back because they don't want to jinx you. All right? It's almost like everyone's ticked off at you. If I was in the big leagues and I was throwing a no-hitter, I would say, you know, continue as normal. Let's joke around in the dugout. Let's talk about it. You don't need to ignore me. Like I got some sort of virus over there and sitting in the corner all by myself. Like Steven Glansberg. Hey, Major League Baseball, we're in about the middle of the season. Big win for the Braves last night, right? So the Braves walk it off against the Giants. This is a big test this week against Trent's Giants. This is a big test this week. You get the Giants, then you get Freddie Freeman and the Dodgers, then you get the Phillies. And this is what I was saying about Atlanta. They went on their 14-game winning streak, but they beat 14 teams with losing records. This is a real test this week to get the Giants, the Dodgers, and the Phillies, and they started off with a big win last night. Pitched well. Max Fried was really good. They get the walk-off. So a good start for Atlanta. Let's see how they do as the week moves forward. In regards to Major League Baseball, when you do look at the standings and you look at the teams doing well, I have always argued for years, even when I was a kid, I could understand this. Growing up as a big-time baseball fan, before I even got into this industry where I had a microphone to voice my opinions, baseball has always needed a salary cap. But it's not to, and I understand the timing of this. I'm a Red Sox fan. I don't like the Yankees. So, you know, it could come off like this is sour grapes because the Yankees have the best record in baseball. And so here I am saying we need to change something in baseball. Right? I could understand the timing of it all and why it looks bad. But this doesn't have to do with the Yankees' success this year. This is about baseball in general. They need a salary cap. And they need a salary cap, more importantly, because of the salary floor, to have teams spend a certain amount. That's the most important. Salary caps, they help. They can only do so much. Golden State Warriors will still spend, right, a lot more money and pay the luxury tax because they have a lot more money, and they're willing to spend more on their team because they, you know, they got a rich owner and no problem. It will curb only so much, but the floor is also very important as well to make sure certain teams are spending money. And when you look at baseball, look at the teams that are doing well. You have the two New York teams are the best. The Dodgers are right there as well. You have the Toronto Blue Jays have the top wild card in the AL, you know, biggest city in Canada. You have the Houston Astros, a big market there in the AL. Even the Braves are the team of the South. So you have kind of the typical teams and also the teams from the bigger markets, which is kind of why, like, with the Minnesota Twins, although they did spend some money with Correa, but what they're doing is impressive, even Cleveland. Right, but then your Kansas City Royals are terrible. Oakland A's spend no money, and they're terrible. The Orioles, the Mariners, the Nationals, the Reds, the Rockies, these teams that are spending no money, they're not in these huge markets. It's not New York or L.A. or even Chicago. They don't have very good baseball teams. And it's just, you know, it's kind of another year in baseball. This is what typically happens. The World Series champ over the last 20 years, all of them have been top 12 in salary cap. In baseball, you got to spend to win. There is no salary cap. I should say all 12 are top. All World Series teams are top 12 in payroll is what I meant to say, because there is no salary cap. The more you spend, the more successful you'll probably be. It may not equal a World Series. You don't necessarily buy a championship, but you certainly buy an opportunity. You buy yourself a seat at the table by spending money in Major League Baseball. And it's easy to put it all like on the owners and blame the owners. But don't forget, when we had the strike in 1994, that was one of the things they were fighting over. And it was the owners who wanted a salary cap that would also include, because they always do, a salary floor as well. And the players didn't want that. And that was part of the lockout or the strike back in 94 in Major League Baseball. So we can call the owners greedy, and they typically are. But also, right, the players didn't want some sort of restriction either. They didn't want some sort of salary cap so that they can make as much money as humanly possible. So we talk a lot about baseball needing a salary cap, and the common retort is like, yeah, but the, you know, those cheap owners, they you know, the owners, you can understand why they'd want a salary cap because they don't want to have to spend so much. But it would also come at least with a floor that would force teams like the Orioles to spend a little more, the Royals. The Tampa Bay Rays are successful, but they spend no money, right? It forced them to spend a little bit more. The Oakland A's never spend any money. A bunch of these teams, the Pirates, have been lousy for years. They don't spend any money. And so here we are, you know, approaching the midway point of the baseball season. And again, pretty typical, the teams that are spending the most. You look at the highest payrolls in baseball, and it's the Yankees and the Mets and the Dodgers and the Astros. And these are the teams that are in first place, the Dodgers that have the best records in baseball. It's no surprise. Just like college football, you can predict who's going to be the best teams going in. Baseball, there's a lot of that as well. Just look at the team spending the most. There's always a surprise, right? Like Cleveland, the fact that Cleveland, they are spending nothing this year, and they're over 500. They're a bit of a surprise. But typically, you know who the teams are that are, you know, the good teams are going to be heading into baseball, and it usually plays out as expected. When we come back, the football teams, college football teams that could be the best over the next 3 years. More Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Spend lunch with Luke.
Attention campers, lunch has been canceled today due to lack of hustle. Deal with it.
On the Morrow Midday Show.
And the wind catches your feet, sends you flying, crying. Ooh-wee. A wild night is calling.
Who will be the best college football teams over the next few years? It's the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. Hey, the big news out of the football world is that Rob Gronkowski reportedly is retiring once again. We'll see if it sticks this time or if he comes back. But Gronk retiring, so Brady loses one of his pals and one of his weapons there in Tampa for the time being at least. Or maybe he'll be like Tom Brady. He'll be retired for about 33 days and then come back. We'll see. It's like the old, and maybe Gronk will never play again. I don't know. I mean, he's taken a beating over the court. That's why he retired the first time. And then he took a little time off, you know, felt good enough to come back. But I remember back when Brett Favre was with the Vikings, and he would, quote-unquote, retire, just to, so he could skip like training camp and then, all right, like I'm ready to go for preseason in August. I'm not saying that's what Gronk is doing. But I also wouldn't be surprised if as we get closer to the season or midseason, like he returns for the second half of the year if the Tampa Bay Bucs are in you know, contention at the top of the NFC. But in the meantime, you take him at his word, and Gronk is retiring, according to reports today. So that's the latest in the world of the NFL. A lot going on in the golf world as well. The PGA Tour trying to keep up with what's going on in their sport. We will talk about that more tomorrow. And Jeremy Schilling, of course, will join us tomorrow. The commissioner of the PGA, Jay Monahan's having a press conference tomorrow while we're on the air, so we'll see what comes from that tomorrow. So could be an interesting day in the golf world. We'll get to all that tomorrow. But ESPN.com put out a story. Adam Rittenberg put together his rankings of the best college football programs for the next 3 years, trying to predict their futures. And his rankings have Alabama at number one, Georgia at number two, Ohio State number three. No surprise there, usual suspects. Then Texas A&M 4, he puts Clemson at number 5 for the next 3 years. After that, Notre Dame is 6, Oklahoma 7, Michigan 8, USC 9, and rounding out the top 10 is LSU. Adam Rittenberg's 10 programs that he thinks will be the best in college football over the next 3 years. And in his breakdowns, he gave each team a future quarterback ranking score as well, future offensive ranking, future defensive ranking. So if you've listened to the Morrow Midday Show before, you probably know where I'm going with this. I'm most concerned about the future quarterback ranking. That's what stands out to me the most. Now, some of it's hard to predict. When you're talking 3 years down the road, who knows? Maybe they bring in, right, one of these programs brings in a talented recruit a year from now, and they could play as a true freshman. Or 3 years from now, they play as a sophomore, their second year, if they come to the program a year from now. And they're an incredible quarterback. They're a Trevor Lawrence. Who knows? It's hard to predict the future when it comes to college sports because of recruiting. In the NFL, right, you think like, yeah, I could see Rodgers being there for three more years or Mahomes. Right, you could try to forecast the future in the NFL a little better, especially with contracts. College football is a little bit different. Transfer portal, recruiting, you have no idea what the quarterback situation will look like in the future. But we can have a pretty good sense. Like Lincoln Riley has always done great with quarterbacks. And now that he's at USC, he's probably going to get great talent as well after Caleb Williams. I assume the quarterback position is always going to be fine for Lincoln Riley at USC. Alabama, it's a safe assumption. They'll always be fine at quarterback under Nick Saban, especially the way they've been pumping them out lately. Georgia, a little bit of a different question if we're being honest here about quarterbacks. I mean, Stetson Bennett, I know he won a national championship and he played pretty well this past year, but he's not one of the best quarterbacks in the country. Will that open the door for some better quarterback play at Georgia, or will they always have to try to, you know, get by with a Stetson Bennett moving forward? But the quarterback ranking is most important for me. So when you look simply off of quarterback ratings, he has Ohio State number one for the next 3 years. Alabama is number three. Texas A&M is number four. I'm trying to find who has number two. I'm looking all over here. Oh, USC number two. Makes sense. Your top four teams. When you get to Clemson for quarterback ranking, they're 17th future quarterback rankings. Now, again, there's a great unknown. Maybe Cade Klubnik is going to turn out to be an incredible talent. Maybe somebody else steps up over the next couple of years at that quarterback position. But that's the big concern to me. Adam Rittenberg has Clemson number one for future defensive rankings for the next 3 years. 13th in offense, 17th in quarterback. And I talked about this last week with Clemson for this upcoming season, that Clemson very well may have the best defense or a top two or three defense in the country this year. Still doesn't necessarily mean they'll win the conference. It takes great quarterback play to win nowadays. So putting Clemson at number five overall over the next 3 years, I don't have a huge issue with it. I'm very curious to see how this year goes. I'm not ready to jump ship yet on Clemson like a lot of people have. But I think you have to show something this year to make me believe you could get right back to that point of competing for national championships like you were, you know, just 2 years ago. A couple of bad years in a row. Maybe you missed the playoff for a second straight year. And then I become a little bit concerned. Not using the transfer portal. Questions at that quarterback position. When I look at these programs, for me, it's a lot about the quarterback ranking is the big one. And while Clemson's number five overall, Adam Rittenberg puts them at number 17 for quarterback ranking. And I think that's a big issue here moving forward. You don't have the same concern for an Alabama, even now a USC, for an Ohio State. And those are the programs you're trying to keep up with. Now, overall, when I look at these rankings, I mean, I don't have any serious issue. Alabama, Georgia, Ohio State top three, sure, that's fine. A&M with the talent they're bringing in, you want to tell me they'll be a top four program the next few years? I could believe it. I could buy it. They've brought in a ton of talent recruiting-wise. Clemson, five. He has Notre Dame, six. I don't know. I'm not as high on Marcus Freeman. I don't know if Notre Dame will be a top six program over the course of the next 3 years. Oklahoma, seven. I don't know if I have that much faith in Brent Venables either. Michigan at number eight. I'm concerned about them this year, but over the long haul, I could give Harbaugh, you know, I'll give him some credit. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. I think USC at number nine is a little too low. I would bump them up. I think they could be a playoff team within the next 3 years. I don't know if I would say the same about Notre Dame or even Oklahoma or even Michigan if they would get back. And the other one, too, outside of the top 10, he has Miami at 11. Maybe I'm just buying into the hype, but I think Mario Cristobal is going to be really good for Miami. And I could see Miami over the next 3 years being better than the 11th ranked program. See, I think the big thing in college football, of course, right, they always say about college sports, the team with the most talent usually wins the majority of the games. And I think the big advantage for Lincoln Riley at USC and Mario Cristobal at Miami is that I think they're going to have a real edge in the talent in their conference. Clemson's the other competition for Miami, but I think Mario Cristobal, he's shown he's a really good recruiter. I think he'll do a great job recruiting Miami, and outside of Clemson, I don't think he'll have a ton of competition of teams in the ACC that will keep up with him. Same idea in the Pac-12. Dan Lanning just took over at Oregon. I think they'll always be okay because it is Oregon, and you got Phil Knight and, you know, all that money and the resources, and I think Dan Lanning will be a good recruiter there as well. But like Utah's a really good program. Kyle Whittingham does a good job there. They're never a top recruiting team. UCLA, never a top recruiting team. Right, USC, now that you have Lincoln Riley, you have the money, you have the resources, and you have the coach. I think they're going to kill it in recruiting compared to the rest of their conference. And so you're going to have such a talent edge, USC will, compared to the rest of their conference. Miami, compared to the rest of their conference, at least outside of Clemson. This would be my forecast for the future. And I think those two teams could do very well in their own conference. A lot of times, all you need is talent to win out. And then when it comes to winning the biggest games, see what happens is you can win the Pac-12 if you're USC just because you have more talent than the rest of the conference. Miami, maybe eventually they get to a point where they win the ACC in the next 5 years just because they have such a talented roster. But if they were to get to the playoff to try to compete with an Alabama, with a Georgia, no longer are you going to have the most talent. That's when it comes to scheme. And I think that may be the difference with Mario Cristobal in terms of the X's and O's trying to out-coach like a Nick Saban or a Kirby Smart. Lincoln Riley, I would trust a little bit more. I think he's a really good offensive mind, but we've seen his teams perform poorly in the playoff. But those are the two crucial parts you need as a coach, right? If you could just bring in a bunch of talent, you're a great recruiter, you can go pretty far. You can't go all the way, but you can get the, you could at least get a seat at the table. And then to try to win once you get there, that's when you have to be a good football coach, a good Saturday coach, X's and O's, to be able to out-scheme the other team when they have that talent advantage. So when I look at the future of a USC and Miami, right, I think these coaches are going to do a good enough job to at least get them to the table. Can they then compete with the best teams in the country in a college football playoff? I'm not so sure. But I think USC and Miami, again, outside of Clemson, will have such a big advantage from their talent on their roster compared to the rest of their conferences that they'll be very successful under these coaches. But when you look at teams and how good they'll be over the next 3 years, as I said, based off of Adam Rittenberg's ranking, I don't have any huge issue with the top five, but I would probably drop Notre Dame from six, Oklahoma at seven. I drop them down, and I would certainly bump up USC, who he has at number nine, and Miami, who he has at 11. I'd bump those two programs up for the next three-plus years in college football. And most importantly, it comes down to quarterback, which is another reason why I like the future of USC with Lincoln Riley. And another reason why you can always trust an Alabama and an Ohio State and maybe Lincoln Riley, and why I would have concerns about a Clemson and even a Georgia at that quarterback position. But you could go see the list for yourself, ESPN.com, Adam Rittenberg, put it together. We will wrap up your Tuesday when we come back. It's the Morrow Midday Show right here on ESPN Radio.
Spend lunch with Luke.
Attention campers, lunch has been canceled today due to lack of hustle. Deal with it.
On the Morrow Midday Show.
My sunny day, Lord, you know it makes me high when you turn your love my way.
Going to the local Whole Foods in Green Bay to go get some kombucha with Blue Sky.
There you go. I don't mind.
A day in the life of Aaron Rodgers. Taking photos with fans.
I saw that in your brain coming. When we were coming back from break, Luke was working on that before.
That song's ruined for me now. Anytime I hear that song, I'm going to think of Aaron Rodgers' new witch girlfriend, Blue of Earth, whatever her name is.
She doesn't identify as a witch.
Hey, if you ever miss anything on the show, such as our conversation earlier about Rodgers in a grocery store and who you would like to run into, you can always find that on demand. Just search ESPN Radio Charleston however you listen to your podcast. And the podcasts are available online at charlestonsportsradio.com. Just click on our show page. We're going to have plenty to dive into in the golf world tomorrow with all that's going on. And Jeremy Schilling will join us as well. We'll probably have some more clarity on Deshaun Watson's situation as we get more information on these reported settlements as well coming out today. And also, we didn't get to this today, but a bit of a terrifying clip involving Jerry Seinfeld and a joke. And I'll explain all that tomorrow on the show as well. Call that a tease. We'll have a lot to do tomorrow. If you ever miss anything from the show, catch it on demand. In the meantime, life is a series of hellos and goodbyes. For now, we say goodbye. We'll say hello again tomorrow at noon. It's the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.